Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Seb Stafford-Bloor of TIFO Football. Now, we can all be diverted by football politics and financial power plays, but on Saturday night, it's the real deal. A Champions League final between two great clubs with great European traditions. Real Madrid, of course, have won the European Cup a record 13 times, Liverpool 6. A seventh title would provide a fitting end to a stellar season. So I suppose the question is, Migs, have they got one more big performance left in them?
Oh yeah, I think so. I mean, there is maybe a slight danger in that. I would argue almost since around the semi-final against Villarreal, actually, Liverpool haven't quite put in the type of a truly dominant display that we've seen define most of their season. But of course, they've generally got the job done. Now, I think possibly for the first time since then, or even longer, they've got a full week's break. There's a good mood. I was at the LMA Awards on Tuesday night, and Klopp's speeches brought the house down, really, including getting quite an enjoyable reaction from Alex Ferguson, who clearly has so much time for him. And again, I mean, and one thing, while obviously a lot of that was Klopp speaking to kind of entertain the room, within it, you could also see, I know this sort of thing has come cliche, but it's true. You can see how he generates such a response and creates the atmosphere he does, because in collecting his own award and the Sir Alex Ferguson Award, he made sure to name check every single member of his staff right up to his personal assistant and tell a little anecdote about them. So, I mean, there's that inclusive atmosphere. And you get the sense that, I mean, despite what happened on Sunday, there is just the right mindset about Liverpool now. And, yeah, I think they've got this big performance in them. And I think it's particularly influential in this final, because there's been an element so far. While I know Madrid have been such a great story in getting this far, it still feels like Madrid's run has been as much about the teams they've played and the situations they've been in as Madrid. Whereas against Liverpool, I mean, like we had Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, who have their own ghosts with the Champions League. Then you have Chelsea, who are going through the uncertainty of a takeover. Whereas Liverpool, like Madrid, are one club who draw on their history in the competition. So in that regard, Madrid lose that advantage, and I think Liverpool have so many strengths. Yeah, I think we will see potentially one last lift.
Would you agree with that, Seb?
Yeah, I do. I think as the season's worn on, I think Miguel touched on this, but I think we've seen Liverpool's power within this, you know, certain chapters of games, rather than within a game itself as an entirety. So the only question, Mike, I have is if you look back at Real's run through the Champions League, their progress has been defined by their ability to capitalise in small moments. Obviously, that ridiculous Benzema hat-trick against PSG, the madness against Chelsea, the greater madness against Manchester City. Real Madrid are a kind of team who seems to sort of profit off the chaos, profit off lapses in concentration, fatigue, tactical uncertainty, these kind of things. And so that's really the only doubt. I think if you line those teams up against each other, I could certainly make an argument for Real Madrid. I could certainly pinpoint some individual issues and some battles and some superiorities they might have, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But I don't think there's an argument that Liverpool aren't the stronger side and player for player aren't the better one. And I also think that, I think what's really interesting, and Migs touched on it with Jurgen Klopp, is that you've got two managers going head-to-head at the end of the season when two teams are running on fumes, but who have two very, very different motivational styles. You know, there's obviously some clear contrast between Carlo Ancelotti and Jurgen Klopp in the way that they kind of galvanise their players, the way they react to individual footballers, and the way that they form bonds with them. That's very interesting because it's almost kind of a face-off in emotional ideology, isn't it? So that's really interesting too. But yeah, no, Liverpool have never had a... When Liverpool have needed a performance, and I think this is true for much of the Klopp era, when they've needed a moment, when they needed a something, when they've needed a reaction, Klopp has always been able to reach down inside his squad and find it from somewhere. And I expect pretty much the same on Saturday, I think.
I think if you look at them, both managers, I think the one thing that unites them is that emotional intelligence, which I think is probably, you know, one of the most definable aspects of the modern game. Just want to take you back, if I could, Mix, to what, you know, that Tuesday night, the LMH dinner. You know, I love the quote that you used from Sir Alex Ferguson about advising Klopp to go to a club with history. You know, I should have told him to go to Scunthorpe United. The thing that struck me about that, one was the respect that you spoke about earlier, but also I think we can really make valid comparisons between the two, can't we?
Oh, yeah, completely. And actually, even if you want to go further, I was thinking about this on Tuesday night, especially now that Klopp is obviously kind of undisputably one of the best managers in the world, maybe the best, but you can, you know, that's a hair-splitting argument. But let's not forget, the first time these two teams met in a final, Real Madrid and Liverpool, or sorry, a final in this era, given this is the third time they've met in an overall. But in 2018, Klopp was basically still considered, yes, a good manager, but making no bones, but he was still considered a loser. So many second places. There are at least some parallels with how, okay, again, different world, different environment, but more so the perception. Where with Ferguson's first 4 years at Manchester United, where he hadn't won a trophy, and an initial second place finish in his first full season gave way to kind of a bad drop off, and basically it was as if, or it was considered that his achievements at Aberdeen, a little like Klopp's achievements at Dortmund at that time, were kind of dismissed a bit, and kind of that doesn't really matter here where it's real. But what was actually happening, of course, where they're putting together these supersides in their own image that would eventually go on these remarkable runs. Again, there aren't complete parallels, different eras, and it's a 30-year gap. But yeah, absolutely. And of course, then we are talking about two of the real greats in the history of the game, particularly given that Klopp, if he wins on Saturday, it will be his second Champions League, which really puts him up on that list. And again, now this is said about pretty much every manager who gets the second, but I suppose the fact that it's Carlo Ancelotti and Zidane, who are still the only one, and Peyton, Bob Paisley, of course, still the only ones on three, shows how difficult it actually is. But really, with Klopp, you wouldn't rule out another and joining that club. But then, of course, Ancelotti might has his own kind of date with history on Saturday night as well. He can win his fourth.
Sure. You know, I think one of the major comparisons said would be that they both Fergie and Klopp took on the burden of history.
Yeah.
You know, both at United and Liverpool. So, Seb, you know, when we look at Klopp, or either both of those managers, they're of their eras. What about their personality types? Is someone like Klopp probably better suited to this 24/7 image-conscious, social media-driven world that football exists in now?
Yeah, I think I'd tend to agree with that. I think I'd add something else in there, which is that Klopp is very comfortable talking about social issues. I think a couple of times this season and the years previous, we've had situations where real world, real significance matters have been raised in press conferences. And I suppose the archetype is of the football manager who's a little bit uncomfortable and says things like, oh, yeah, I'm just here to talk about goals and tackles and tactics and that kind of stuff and leave me alone. And, you know, I don't read the front of the newspaper. And to an extent, I get that because it's really easy to slip up in that environment and to be misinterpreted or willfully misinterpreted sometimes. Klopp is very at ease. Klopp is very at ease. And he's also very comfortable in his own skin because you see someone who is very happy to speak his mind. He's very happy to be sincere. And doesn't kind of, I think sometimes when you hear managers talk about real world issues, when they do express themselves, they do it in the way that all of modern football does about pretty much anything. They're worried about saying too much. They're worried about being a little bit too forthright. And so they stay well within the margins, so to speak. With Klopp, he's very straightforward. This is what I think about this. And invariably, when you hear him speak about things like that, you end up nodding along and agreeing. And he just comes across as a very decent person. And I wonder whether, and it's very difficult to speak for a modern professional footballer. Unfortunately, I am nearly 40, so it's not my generation anymore, sadly. But
look,
if you're
young, from the end, my end of the telescope, mate,
that did make me feel better, mate. Thank you very much. So, if I was a young player now and I was growing up in this world, I would respond very well to somebody like that who didn't treat football as a bubble, who didn't think that it was a vacuum in which nothing else in the world matters. You get someone who seems very worldly, I think, and someone who has a proper social conscience. And I think that's very important. Like, I think obviously there's a lot more to constructing and motivating a football team than that, but it really, really helps. It's a very important starting point.
Mm. Yeah. Inevitably, I suppose, a lot of Manchester City fans were affronted that Klopp won the LMA Manager of the Year award. Miggs, was that the usual performative nonsense, or did it have some validity given that Pep Guardiola has won 10 titles in his 13 seasons as a manager?
Yeah, but I suppose the LMA award, it's not about your recent history, it's about the season. And the issue for City there, and this is something that has been touched upon all season, and that Guardiola started to reflect himself, is that, or that really the lack of appreciation, is that when you're at Manchester City, basically winning the league is a par performance. You should be winning the league. And this shouldn't be overlooked in all this. I mean, some of it is, of course, just supposed to play people react to these things. But ultimately, an award like the LMA, it's not an award for winning the league. That's the trophy. That's your medal. It's an award. What a Manager of the Year award should really be about is how well anyone has done with their given resources and whether they've overperformed or not. And in that regard, you wouldn't actually say Guardiola has necessarily overperformed this season, because again, they should be finishing top. Had he added a Champions League to that, then yes, of course it would have overperformed. But that's the price of being in a club like City. And yes, Klopp himself is at a super club, and obviously where the resources are. I mean, it is an issue of scale. I mean, it was obviously so far beyond Thomas Frank's Brentford, who would have been a vote for me for Manager of the Year. But at the same time, it's about scale. Klopp is at a super club, yes, but Liverpool are just not as wealthy as a state project in Manchester City. So to keep pace with them in the way they've done, and not just keep pace, because the thing about this sort of thing is, usually when clubs are competing with someone of better resources, there has to be compromises somewhere. So, like Pochettino, again, Liverpool are a wealthier club than Liverpool. But one way that Pochettino had got around that was basically he just wrote off the two domestic cups. He didn't play the same strength of 11 in them, so he could focus everything on the league and Champions League that he felt mattered more than anything. Whereas Klopp now, we're in a season where, despite where you think he'd have to make compromises, we could see him win every single domestic cup and go within a point, or sorry, every single cup potentially, and go within a point of City in the league, which is an immense achievement. Now, I suppose it is maybe the slight danger of when the award arrives, and that will feel very different if he wins the Champions League or if he doesn't. But if he wins it, certainly, it does kind of after the fact, make the award on Tuesday night look better. But it was interesting, actually, while there was unanimous applause in the room for Klopp, clearly well appreciated, there was a smattering of boos when Guardiola's name was read out for the nomination.
I can't think where that came from. Carlo Ancelotti, Seb, seeking to become the first manager to win the Champions League four times. You know, his breadth of achievement is amazing. Winner of all five big leagues. It's quite remarkable to think that not so long ago, he was Klopp's other half on Merseyside, isn't it?
Yes, that seems like a dream, doesn't it? It seems like something that we all imagined. One of the things that occurred to me this week about Carlo Ancelotti, and I suppose it was in light of the Kylian Mbappe news, is that I still think the work he's done at Real Madrid this season is kind of underappreciated, because you need to remember what he inherited. Now, obviously, Real Madrid only found out that Kylian Mbappe wasn't coming to Spain last weekend, but a lot of their organisational energy and resources have been focused towards that moment for a long time, to the point where they have weakened themselves in expectation that he would join. Think about some of the sales over the last couple of years, but, you know, allowing someone like Rafa Varane to leave the club to free up wage space. I believe that at the beginning of the season, Ancelotti was told that his wage bill would be trimmed so that they could afford Kylian Mbappe at the end of the year, which I know it's not like this at a club like Real Madrid, but it's kind of like, right, well, we're writing this off, aren't we? So just do your best, and then in a year's time, you'll have Mbappe and you can go win everything. And the guy wins La Liga very, very comfortably. I know Barcelona had a down year, and Atletico Madrid were a little bit of a mixed bag this year, but look at the clubs that he's knocked out in the Champions League. It's an amazing achievement. And it's also, I look at some of those players at Real Madrid and see some of the kind of the individual improvements. Vinicius we'll probably talk about a little bit more, and his improvement's probably been going for, I'd say maybe about 18 months, where you've seen him go from being a very, very promising player to a really excellent one. But look at someone like Rodrigo this year. Rodrigo, obviously highly talented when he came in, had a couple of moments in the Champions League which caught people's attention. Under Ancelotti, he's become a difference maker, which is really, really interesting. Militao, I think, has had his better season, a better season under Ancelotti. I think the midfield is interesting. I think what he's done with Fede Valverde is shown a side of the player that I didn't realise existed, because he's a bit more box-to-box, a bit more vertical than previously. It's an amazing body of work. And actually, the Everton thing, and I don't mean any disrespect when I say this, although, you know, I'm sure the internet is always very forgiving, isn't it? I don't mean any disrespect, but it's like, it's very strange that someone like that was at Everton, given where Everton exists within the food chain. Not this season, and not the calamities and all the nonsense that took place, but typically, like, you know, sort of between the 8th and 6th place in the Premier League, and you've got someone like this managing there. It's very, very strange. I'll say Everton isn't a very large club, but it's just, in the contemporary sense, it was a little bit incongruous. But Ancelotti has done amazing things. And I think one of the problems for him is in the internet age, I think it's very easy to assess coaches and assess coaching quality by the kind of the bite-sized nuggets which make it out onto social media. So it's like, oh, look at him. He's raised his eyebrow there. That makes a great coach. Or his team has scored a goal and all he's done there is blow on his hot cup of coffee or hot cup of tea. And you think, well, okay, it's fun. Yeah, but it kind of diminishes the man. There's a gravity to Carlo Ancelotti. I'd recommend anyone read his book, actually. It's very, very
good.
Interesting.
It's very good.
Very,
yeah.
Interesting. And it's you understand a little bit more than, I think, kind of one of the narratives around him is, oh, he does well because players like him. Yeah, okay, they do. But there's a lot more substance to it than that. And I think it's a great thing. Like, I really have a horse in the race, but I think whatever happens on Saturday, whichever manager wins, I think it's a great story. Ancelotti winning 4 European Cups, it's ridiculous. It's an amazing achievement. And I hope that provides a little bit of, yeah, a layer of gravitas to someone that has possibly just been dismissed a little bit too much sometimes as everybody's mate, which I think is a little bit of a disservice.
I'm going to offer a little bit of edge to that.
Oof, interesting. Okay.
First, I was thinking about Ancelotti, and like, I mean, what marks him out is he's very obviously a very good man. And in a world where the demands of football management are such, the most charitable description is a lot of top managers have to be quite spiky people and unpleasant in a lot of circumstances, or circumstances that don't go away. Where Ancelotti's never had that. Now, that's arguably one reason, though, why he is not, I should couch this just before, that there will be an explanation, just because it's possibly a remarkable thing to say when someone's on the brink of winning 4 Champions Leagues. But it's why he's not an absolutely top manager at least in the modern game. I mean, there's a reason he was at Everton, because he couldn't really get top jobs anymore. There was a reason he went back to Madrid, because this is a club, as the Mbappe deal shows, and as the run to the Champions League in its own way, or rather the perception of it shows, in that this is essentially the biggest club in European history was an underdog story, right down to the fact that they appropriated an underdog phrase in Spain, which is "Si se puede, yes we can." They're a club in decline, and there is a potential, as the Mbappe deal emphasised, that this run could end up being similar, coincidentally enough, to AC Milan 2007, the last hurrah of an old era, because the world is changing around this club. And that's why Ancelotti was there, because they couldn't get one of the kind of super coaches now. And it's always been the interesting thing with Ancelotti, and this superb Champions League record is offset by what is actually, even though, again, we have this stat that he's the first manager to win all five major European titles, but they're actually the only five titles of his career. And that's despite spending, what, at least 15 to 19 years, you can get, I suppose, a few are down to perception, at always the, I mean, it's similar like what we're saying about Pep Guardiola here, but at always the best resourced, best run or biggest club in the country he's been in at that time. If we're going from the Guardiola perspective earlier, it's almost performing under par. And there is an argument that comes down to the fact that in modern leagues, you need that intensity that Ancelotti doesn't really have. I mean, like at Bayern Munich, they were shocked at the drop off in coaching and training after having experienced Guardiola. Now, that's obviously natural, I suppose, given Guardiola's intensity, but it's relevant to this discussion. But of course, the flip side of all that is, and as we've seen that Champions League record, is that in games, in these big games and in moments, as Seb alluded to there, Ancelotti is better than anyone at just knowing that he's got that emotional intelligence that a lot of these more intense managers maybe don't. That's really what elevates his career. And maybe it's why he has this slightly contradictory record. But yeah, but certainly he's in such an interesting position as well going into this Champions League final. Let's not forget, had it not been for the win against Paris Saint-Germain, even right up to the semi-final, there was talk that if they lost the semi-final badly, the second leg, and despite winning the title, Florentino Perez was going to sack Ancelotti. Now, again, that's Perez. But it does show that they ultimately want to bring in a modern super coach in that regard.
Well, we are dealing, aren't we, Migs, with someone who's using the cumulative experience of 45 years in the game. Now, it's always struck me that his trust in his players and his staff was probably the biggest compliment you can pay to him and probably his best asset. But there's one thing struck me, and you know, you talked about the contradictions of the man. In the Real Madrid Open Day on Tuesday, he spoke about issues before big games, accelerated heart rate, private moments of negativity and doubt, which is obviously an indication or another indication of the realities of management. Did that admission, which basically goes against the whole trademark image of coolness under pressure, did that surprise you?
Yeah, a little bit. And again, it's kind of the typical frankness and genuine nature he speaks about these things. But I suppose what points to his record and his supreme ability to manage these occasions is how he responds to them himself. I mean, there's a story that we had during the season, which was just before Benzema's hat-trick against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, possibly his performance of the campaign, although it's one of many. Benzema actually turned up to the stadium without his accreditation. And there was a brief, bizarre point where it looked like Benzema mightn't be let in. But of course, they managed to get in, but he was naturally very aggravated and very animated. Ancelotti just had an immediate instinct for taking the thing out of it by just kind of joking to him, "We're going to play the kit man instead, you can sit this one out." And then Benzema immediately started laughing. And again, I suppose it's, given the way he spoke on Tuesday, it's that thing of being able to mask what he might internally be feeling and radiate the best possible mood for his players for these big games.
Yeah, I think also, and you alluded to it earlier, Seb, what he's quietly doing is restocking and remodeling that Madrid team. Let's look at some of the specific players. You know, you mentioned, you know, two of them earlier, you know, Vinicius and Rodrigo. Also Camavinga, you know, the prospect of him having being in the same midfield next season as Tchouameni, who seems likely to prefer Madrid to Liverpool, but PSG are having a sniff, so who knows what's going to go on there. But I suppose my basic point is that even in a season like this, he's stocking up for tomorrow, isn't he? It's not just about today.
100%. Camavinga is a mighty talent. I think, obviously, we knew his name. I saw a little bit of him playing when he was playing in Liga, but I don't think anybody really expected his adaption. I don't think anybody expected his adaption to involve so many crucial moments in big games. Let's put it that way, because he's been a very important piece in the Champions League. I agree wholeheartedly, Mike, with the restocking and kind of I'd call it almost a gentle evolution away from, like, if you think about how long that midfield was together, the midfield, the, you know, the Modric, Kroos, Casemiro midfield, how that's evolving, how the forward line has changed. The only question mark I have is, in the aftermath of Mbappe, Tchouameni is expected to come in, yes, but Florentino Perez needs a political win, because obviously Mbappe not joining is a huge political disappointment, which comes off the back of Super League, a couple of disappointing seasons, some fairly meager transfer recruitment. Not bad, just not attention-seeking in the way that it used to be under Perez. And so you just wonder within that context whether there's a big, shiny spanner to come into the works somewhere, a player that, you know, is in Congress who doesn't fit, who disrupts what's happening. I don't know. It just, in this kind of situation with characters like that, they don't tend to respond that positively to having their ego bruised, because this is a very public humiliation. Fortunately, Javier Tebas has deflected some of the attention away from that. But
that was one of the great hissy fits of our time, wasn't it?
It was kind of magnificent in a way, yes. You know, threatening to take PSG to the Hague or something, I don't know. So I just wonder. I think, yeah, a little bit of a hesitant but curious eye over the activity at Real Madrid this summer, I think, probably.
Yeah, well, as you say, the stakes have certainly been raised by Mbappe's rejection. I suppose that points up, doesn't it, Migs, the pressure of playing for such a politically febrile club. You know, you only need to look at the victims, or, you know, victims of a kind. You know, Eden Hazard, he's had three wasted seasons. You know, is there also any sense of sadness that it looks like Gareth Bale is unlikely even to make the bench on Saturday, which is a pretty sad way to go out?
A little bit. And it's always impossible to square this situation that Bale is in at Madrid, where to look at his name so frequently absent, you think, this guy's past it, you know, like, he's just running out his contract. Then you watch him for Wales, and we're still talking about one of the most devastating players in international football. The performance against Austria was something else. So it is, but then, of course, that's down to something a lot bigger than Bale's form, and points to the political nature of a club like this. But then, of course, one of the more interesting things about this, it's something that may have to change about Madrid, that the Mbappe situation emphasised, and that, I mean, and even the Hazard signing now feels like, I mean, it was pre-pandemic, it was the last summer before the pandemic, actually, but it feels like a transfer from a different world, and that Madrid flexing their muscles against one of the petrol clubs, even Chelsea's ownership has obviously changed now, but in 2019 it was kind of, you know, still Abramovich a year before he's going to spend 200 million. And they basically strong arm Chelsea out of one of their better players, whatever bit's happened since with Hazard. Whereas now, Madrid have to get used to a new reality, and they can't really look to signing the world's top stars anymore because they just don't have that money. They have to look to sign the next best thing, which is pretty much what they've been trying to do. And it's even a reflection of that they tried to do that with Mbappe. They were going to sign him on a free contract.
Let's look at the game in the round, if we could, please, Seb, the final in the round. Where do you think Liverpool can lose this game?
I think we touched on it at the beginning, Mike. I think Madrid profit in the chaos. I think if Liverpool end up losing this game, I think what will end up happening is that we will be talking in the aftermath about a period of about 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes, where something has happened, something that doesn't necessarily fit the overall pattern of the game. There are some tactical concerns. I think, I mean, be careful how I frame this, because I don't believe it's kind of an individual failing, but I think Vinicius versus the kind of the channel, the Liverpool right-hand channel. And I don't think of that as a, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold is an inferior defender. I don't think he is. I think some of the issues that he encounters are a quirk of Liverpool's system and are a facet of his role. Like, he is not a fullback. It's just the terminology around his position doesn't exist properly, really. It hasn't been invented, I guess. But there is space behind him because that's what Liverpool concede, and their centre-backs are good enough to allow that. When you add someone like Vinicius into that, it worries me a little bit, because I think one of the developments, yes, there's been a greater tangible output to his game over the last 18 months, 2 years. I think he's also a more direct player. I think he plays in straighter lines than he used to before. I think I always thought of him as a quick player. I think it's only really this season that I've realised just how devastatingly rapid he can be. And that's a problem. Like, there will be a counter-attacking issue. We're recording this on a Thursday. I'm still not entirely sure whether Thiago is going to play. I think, first of all, if he doesn't play, I think it's a great shame. He's one of the world's best footballers. I think one of the passes that I enjoy watching the most in the game today. This is just a real artistry and craft of the way he uses the ball. I think that changes
That pass against Wolves, by the way, was amazing, wasn't it?
But then I think I could add like three or four of his passes into that bracket, Mike. I think what I enjoy about him the most is just the way he kicks footballs. We get lost in what every pass means and, like, you know, how many defenders it takes out and, you know, angles and all that kind of stuff. But, like, professional footballers kick footballs in very unique ways. Like,
they sound different. If you're on the training pitch.
Thank you. Yeah. You're in the stadium, and if you get to a stadium early and you're watching a warm-up and the crowd isn't in and it's a little bit echoey, go and stand as close as you can to the pitch and just watch. Because it's and Thiago's a great example of that, because it's so precise. It's like watching somebody. It's like he hits the sweet spot of the ball every single time, and the angle of his foot, and watch where he looks when he's passing. It's the cliche, so apologies for that. But he's someone who, if he was just kicking balls around on a training pitch by himself in the middle of nowhere, you'd probably go and watch that too, and probably pay to do so. And so that's a real shame. So him being missing alters the entire tone of that midfield. I think Liverpool have the players to compensate for that. It's just that he is the best of them, the one I enjoy watching the most. But I think that Vinicius matchup is a little difficult. Also, I'd say, and it's going to come off a little bit of a criticism, but there have been a few rickets in Andy Robertson's game over the last couple of weeks, a few kind of positional misnomers that have occurred. I don't know the tactical explanation for that. I don't even know if it's fair to attribute them to kind of individual error. That might be doing him a disservice. But I've seen some trouble in that area. And so when you add in Rodrigo, or you add in a couple of the players that Real can use in that area, so like Valverde has been used there at different times. Ancelotti has a wealth of talent to come off the bench and to kind of inject into the game sort of 15, 20 minutes at the end if he needs to. So a little bit of trouble around Liverpool's fullbacks, but that's kind of as a symptom of the way they play, I guess.
Mm. What about the midfield balance and battle, Migs? You know, again, it will be obviously a huge creative blow if Thiago doesn't make it. But, you know, when you look at, you know, the, let's call it the Modric Kroos axis, that can win any game, can't it?
For a time, although it is actually interesting throughout the season, and particularly in that last Champions League game against Manchester City, that Ancelotti hasn't been afraid to remove either of them. And again, I suppose this is his instinct for the run of these games and what's needed. But I think it also speaks to maybe the nature of the players in the midfield as well. I mean, that, you know, on the face of it, if you take the first 11s, this could really be, or this midfield battle could be something where it's basically the kind of poise and control of Modric and Kroos in particular, with Casemiro behind him. Well, Casemiro doesn't have the legs he used to. against, in most cases, with Thiago the exception in it, but it'd be all the more interesting maybe if he doesn't start in this regard, the pure running of Liverpool's midfield. Now, again, Klopp is evolving that, but it could be a game then, even more so than everything played so far, where Ancelotti very much has a need to eventually bring on Camavinga or just change the dynamic of his side, because there is at least the possibility that Modric and Cruz, that modern Madrid starting Madrid midfield as a whole, mightn't be able to keep up with Liverpool in the middle. So I think it's just another kind of element of this game that will elevate it, but also points to kind of loads of little clashes between two sides and how they're almost opposites in that way.
Yeah. So I asked you where Liverpool could lose it, Seb. Where can they win it?
That's a longer answer, isn't it? obviously, like, the obvious places are at the feet of Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane. I think one of the interesting things actually is the evolution and the change in Liverpool's attacking dynamics, because I think they're a lot less predictable. It sounds like a pejorative term, but they've changed. Like, I think now when you face Liverpool, you don't necessarily know, you don't understand the threat as much as you used to. A lot of teams understood the threat and were completely incapable of dealing with it and nullifying it, I admit. But now I think you still have Salah playing some of the best football of his career, but you have someone like Mane inhabiting slightly different areas of the pitch. Like, he's become a little bit more centre-based. There's a little bit more, dare I say, number 10-ish quality to him sometimes. I think Diaz is a fascinating addition to that side, because I think we covered before when I've been on, we talked about how quickly he adjusted. Very true. But also, I think there's something that he brings to this side, which is that, like, he is able to... One of the interesting things about him is he's able to compensate for Mane moving inside. So if you shift Mane into a central area and play Diaz off the left, then you're kind of replicating a lot of those abilities. You're not losing anything from that area by shifting Mane. And also, it's a very basic point, but if you look at the way those attackers match up individually with any defenders, well, what's the answer to them? Like, sometimes when you face teams, you think, right, well, if I'm going to face Mesut Ozil, I'm going to give him a bit of a kicking. I'm going to keep him on his right foot. You know, I'm going to keep him away from the penalty area, but I'm also going to make sure that when he drops, I don't get sucked away from the defensive line, that kind of stuff. With Liverpool, I think one of the most admirable qualities that Klopp has created is there are no real answers to them. Like, yes, they're going to leave themselves open to a counterattack, and like teams who have that capability, teams like, I don't know, Tottenham in the past, have shown that they can hurt Liverpool. At the same time, there aren't many answers to them defensively. You can sit deep and hope for the best and say, right, well, okay, Mohamed Salah, Thiago Alcantara, Sadio Mane, you can shoot from 25 yards, but at the same time, all of those players can find the top corner. So that's not a great strategy. So they can win it everywhere. And that's really the kind of... that's the measure of them as a side. There's not a single thing that Real have to stop. It's like five or six different things. And as a matchup, that's impossible. Like, beating Liverpool, you need to have luck to do it. And you need to play at the very, very top of your game. And there aren't many sides, not even now in the kind of contemporary game, in history, you can say that.
Mm. What did you make, Migs, of Mo Salah's comments at Liverpool's open day on Wednesday, where, you know, he said, look, I'm going to be here next season, because, you know, there were the obvious and inevitable links to Real Madrid's rebuild, you know, in the aftermath of Mbappe's decision. Is that a pretty clever move by Salah and his people? Because essentially what he's going to do is run down his contract, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And very much kind of a political move as well, actually, a political statement that it gives him an out either way. If he agrees to a new deal, well, you know, he hasn't said he's leaving. It's also why more interesting, I thought, was Sadio Mane's answer, where he refused to comment on his future at all and said he'll do so after the final. That was remarkable. And I suppose some of this stuff is actually, usually the players comment on their future in this way, and kind of the endless fixation on the future or on transfers ahead of games of historic importance is a little bit tedious. But in this, it's actually directly relevant, because the fallout from the Mbappe transfer has obviously left Madrid scrambling for other options. And there has been some expectation from within Liverpool that, well, what are the bets on in the days leading up to the final? We see a few well-timed or kind of conspicuously timed Marca or AS front pages essentially announcing Madrid's interest or attempted negotiations with two of Liverpool's stars. And that's surely something that's going to happen in the next 2 days. But yeah, I suppose with Salah, he gives himself an out, but of course confirms he'd be there. With Mane, well, let's see what happens next. But I suppose the genius of Klopp at Liverpool is that he almost solves these problems before they become a problem, because they're already on to the next signing. So already, if it's Mane that goes in the summer, well, they've already got his ready-made replacement in Luis Diaz.
Yeah, I suppose it points out the fact that players are becoming increasingly cute in the way that they administer their political and financial power. That then leads us into, Seb, the broader aspects of this final and whether or not it's actually going to be the last of its era. And by that, I mean, you know, if you look at it, Real Madrid, fading aristocrats, they're still printing their own money to buy players, but, you know, they have a ceiling. You've got Liverpool, which is a brilliantly run modern club, you know, analytically sound. The breadth of their staffing and the intelligence of their staffing is terrific on and off the pitch. Yet, strange as it may seem, these clubs are almost out of their time, aren't they? Because we are entering, or we may already be, in the era of state-sponsored football.
Yeah. It's all very depressing. I think because, and I've reflected on this quite a lot over the past few months, just because I feel like drop by drop, sort of the aspiration is going out of the game. I think if you look at sort of the business practices of some of the teams at the top of the food chain, some of the teams that are financed by petrostates and oligarchs, I think the aim is to take the element of competition out of the sport. It's not to succeed. It's not to build a project. And it's not to construct something out of marginal gains and clever recruitment and good signings and all the things that we traditionally associate with excellence. It's to ensure that nobody is able to actually compete with the level of resources. I was having a conversation on social media the other day with somebody. It's about an unrelated matter, but it applies here. And that I think one of the problems now in the game is that it doesn't matter when you make mistakes. Like at the Paris Saint-Germain season, I think, you know, they may have won the French title, but it is a disaster and it's had several really low points. I mean, their own players have been booed at the Parc des Princes. The Champions League, well, it's become an annual event, hasn't it? You know, where the world laughs at Paris Saint-Germain as they trip themselves over in the Champions League yet again. And yet their season began with one of the most decadent transfer windows the world has ever seen. It's all gone wrong. And you'd think ordinarily, goodness, if you sign Leo Messi and Sergio Ramos and Donnarumma and you already have the existing wage bill that you have, and then you renew Kylian Mbappe, you know, somewhere else, surely at some point you're going to have to compromise somewhere. There's going to have to be a kind of a yin to that yang and a sort of, right, well, you know, this guy's going to have to go. And it just doesn't exist. It doesn't exist, does it? It's not like the normal rules of football don't apply. And so there's never the perception of any kind of weakness, or there's no perception that as a team not in that bracket, you can take advantage of something somewhere. And that's very dangerous. And I think it affects the way that I personally look at the game, because it leaves me, you know, looking forward into the next 5 or 10 years with a massive sense of, oh, what is actually the point of any of this? Because it's all going to end very, very predictably. And I don't mind that my own team doesn't win anything. I don't really have a problem with that. I mind that a world is being created in which it is actually impossible, that it's not about my own team's, you know, capacity to find disaster and to do stupid stuff in the latter stages of competition. They've taken Spursiness away from me, if that makes sense. And it's very troubling. And I can see a period of time in the future where I'm just not that interested in football, which...
I think there's an even... Now, obviously, there are so many issues with this era. Now, let's not forget that the paramount among everything should basically be about the political use of the game to, I mean, the phrase is now sports washing, states responsible for essentially denial of human rights. But one of many other less important negative effects, but still important in their own way, it's something I've noticed in the last few weeks, even in previous seasons. Whereas because, say specifically in the case of City here, but really they should be similar in France, and it's why the apathy in France towards this, and even the state getting involved in say, the Mbappe deal, well, not the state, but even Macron and Sarkozy getting involved in the Mbappe deal is all the more remarkable. But it's that Manchester City have so much money to the point that, as we said earlier, them winning the title is pretty much a par, that it's become just an acceptable outcome. And what I've noticed among fans of other clubs, and certainly some of the discussion on social media, all of that, is that it means in any sort of race, supporters of other clubs want City to do well, because to them, their title doesn't really have emotional meaning. Whereas obviously if, say, for United fans or Everton fans, Liverpool winning it would. For, say, Spurs against City in the Champions League in 2019, Arsenal fans would have been desperate for City to win just because it would have been Spurs. So they've become almost this useful patsy to prevent teams you are emotionally invested in, if for the negative, to not win anything. But that means then that, so football is the most, just by definition, but the amount of people that love it, is the most emotionally moving sport in the world. We shouldn't really be in a situation where the outcome of a major competitions produces this, where there's not much emotional reaction. And it is connected to this financial superiority. I for me, that's the game drifting into quite an ominous place. And again, typically in the way these things go, a place where without people in charge really realizing it, potentially realizing the dangers of all this too late, right down to the fact that the Premier League just waved through the Newcastle takeover. And one response to that you always hear is that you need these takeovers now to compete. Now, that's actually true, but again, that's not a good thing. And that means we should be addressing issues like financial disparity in football. That's something that the bodies in charge of football, right up to the UEFA, that's what they should be really tackling. That's what they should be looking at. But they keep sidestepping these issues, as we can see with the new Champions League reforms. But if that creates a world where the Premier League ends up being Abu Dhabi's Manchester City against Saudi Arabia's Newcastle United, that's absolutely grotesque. I mean, football, as you've said there, Seb, I mean, football is really, given its social meaning above anything else, it really shouldn't just be a plaything for these sort of states. That to me is it's a really ominous place toward that the game is going to. But that's where we are. And then, I mean, if you want to look at France, it makes it all the more. I mean, the French league is basically just being gutted. And yet, even though it's being gutted and it's becoming anti-sport, we have this situation where some of the leading politicians in France are basically lobbying, because that's what it is, lobbying for more PSG power by making sure that Kylian Mbappe stays in the country and making these overtures to him. And it's one thing that's always struck me about French football, like the complete apathy towards what Paris Saint-Germain are. Now, I suppose some of it is connected to the fact that, you know, it does make the league glamorous, but then I'd rather have a competitive league than a glamorous league, something that's entertaining to watch. But then I suppose maybe we can't get too over the top of that, given it's something it very often feels there's a similar dynamic in England, and we could well realise the problematic state the game is in way too late, or at least the football authorities could. And it's why I must say I've been so disappointed in Sheffield and UEFA in this regard. Basically, there's never been a greater space or a greater necessity for football leaders with true vision.
So given all that, we need a classic final, don't we? Final question to both of you. Do you think we're likely to get it? And if so, who's going to win it? Seb.
Yeah, France, Mark, I just want to add something to what Miguel says, because it really resonated with me. Like, If we exist in a game where, if we have a game around us where the ultimate ambition at the end of each season is for these teams to kind of be that, you know, to nullify the ambitions of our rivals, that's a really dangerous place. Like I watched Eintracht against Rangers in the Europa League final last week, and it was great. Like, it was great drama. I didn't really care who wins. I have a little bit of a lean towards the German side because I live there, and Eintracht's a good story. Like, if you're taking these kind of things away, so instead of like Eintracht against Rangers, I'm watching Manchester City against PSG, or Like, that's not really the football that I signed up for. Yeah, but I'll get back to the point. I think we get a good final. I think these teams are really well matched. I think what I like about them is that it's a final that puts a lot of really, really good footballers on the same pitch. A good footballers in the kind of the classic sense, ball players, like footballers, ambition, flair, creativity. And there's some great stories there. There's some really great stories. Sadio Mane potentially winning absolutely everything by the Premier League in the same calendar year is an amazing story. Karim Benzema perhaps making his case even more solid for the Ballon d'Or. Like, it's just, it's got everything that you want. And I've got an emotional draw to that in a way that I wouldn't have to some of the things that Miguel described so eloquently a couple of minutes ago.
So is it going to give you a reason to believe, Migs?
I do think it'll be a good game. I mean, it's interesting. Just I've done a big piece in the State of the Modern Champions League for today, Thursday morning. And it's this almost contradiction of the Champions League, where it's been so entertaining over the last few years. In fact, four of the highest scoring seasons since the Champions League's formation from the European Cup in 1992, four of the highest scoring seasons have come in the last 6 years. And we're talking about goal returns that we haven't really seen since the 1960s. So it's a golden age of Champions League in one sense, but also all that entertainment is an antidote, and sort of a cause of the kind of sameness of the competition, where it's always the same teams involved. So there's actually just both kind of a freshness and a staleness about it. And I would say so far this season, it's actually been the most entertaining Champions League since 2018-19, which was Liverpool Spurs in the final. And that season had everything bar a good final. This season maybe has been brilliant, maybe not quite as much drama. So in that 2018-19 season, there were 6 second leg comebacks. This season there's only been 2, both of them, of course, from Real Madrid. But that season was lacking the final to match. Hopefully this season we do have the final match, and I'm quite optimistic about that, I have to say. And it's probably, I mean, given what we're talking about, it's amazing to say this, given this is the final with more history than any other, where basically there's 19 European Cups involved, and Madrid have had 13, Liverpool have had 6. There's never been so many European Cups represented in one final. And yet, despite that display of power, this is actually quite a relatively healthy final, because Liverpool, even though their owners, essentially, you know, the kind of the venture capitalists, they're still a club run on relatively progressive grounds in that regard. Even though Madrid are run by Florentino Perez, they're still a member-owned club. And both of these are kind of, they're trying to seek out ways to be defiant against this state, against these state clubs, which is pretty much the best you can offer in the modern game. So from that regard, and I suppose it's this statement in itself is an indication of where football is, this is actually a relatively healthy final.
Okay, one word answers, please, chaps. Who wins? Seb?
Liverpool.
Migs?
Yeah, Liverpool for me.
Yeah, I see no reason to argue against that. I've actually got a hunch that this final might be one for the ages. You know, Real Madrid's progress to Paris has been thrillingly unpredictable, consistently uplifting. Liverpool, at times this season, have been a force of nature. If you look around, there have probably been inevitable signs of physical and mental decline in recent weeks, but their collective will is so, so strong, I take them to win probably by the odd goal in 5. In the meantime, thanks to Seb and Miguel for not just their insights today, but for throughout this season. Thanks, chaps. And thank you all for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.